Thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss a remarkable topic. Prenup forms, new and old. My only correction is I think it should be old and new. You start from the beginning and proceed. Time does not allow to go into the details of my sources that I have here, nor to translate them. But I'll try to begin from the beginning and proceed. We know that prenuptial obligations begin in the Holy Torah, the Torah itself. As a matter of fact, in a portion of the Torah which we will read this coming Shabbos afternoon, we read She'era Ksusa Lo Yigra, which means that a husband must provide, as some understand it, food and clothing for a spouse. There's a major dispute in the Talmud and Masechta Ksubos, but this obligation, known as mizonos, as support for food, is a Torah obligation, or in fact is a rabbinic obligation. And the word she'er can be interpreted differently. What I'd like to explain to you this morning, I believe is, this afternoon, I believe is that even those who maintain, as the Talmud would have it, that mizonos derabbanan, that the obligation of support is rabbinic, they will very likely concede that a fundamental, minimalistic base of support is a Torah obligation. And some of the sources that I quoted here demonstrate that. The word she'er, which we understand to mean food, if it doesn't mean food, likely means something which is the flesh. To sustain the flesh, the bare minimum, to keep the person alive, is likely, according to all, a Torah obligation. What then is the rabbinic obligation? So the sources provide for us that this obligation goes way beyond the minimum of keeping a person alive. How far does it go? So we are taught that it goes to the higher of the standard of living of the man and the woman. A remarkable turn of a phrase in the Torah, which means something completely different in a simple understanding, based on the word be'ulas baal. The Gemara in Ksubas understands ola imo ve'eina yoredes imo, which means she will ascend to a higher level of support if, in fact, his level is higher than hers, but eina yoredes imo, she won't go down if her level is higher than his. So this is what we understand to be the obligation of mizonos of support by a Torah law and by a rabbinic law. Now, it's interesting, some claim that even if, strictly speaking, the letter of the law tells us that it's only rabbinic, perhaps every single husband accepts upon himself privately an obligation, and obviously privately accepted obligations are affected by Torah law. How so? So in every Ksuba, the first line, now this source I will read to you, because we have it incorporated into our prenup. It begins with a phrase which, in my source sheet, is source number one. It's a line at the very beginning of the Ksuba. V'ana'efrach v'okir v'ezan v'afanei sichilichi gozguven yudayim t'polchon umokon v'zanam n'afanei n'ashem v'kushta. Roughly translated, I will work, cherish, feed, and support you according to the laws of Jewish husbands who work, cherish, feed, and support their wives faithfully. As a matter of fact, if you look at the our prenup, you will see the paragraph 3, the first line, I obligate myself to support my wife to be according to the requirements of Jewish law governing Jewish husbands. That's a reference to what we just said. So therefore, it's very possible, some suggest, that even if there would be no such document, the obligation would be rabbinic in nature. Once a document is signed, it rises to a level of a Torah obligation. This is not unanimously accepted. There are those who maintain that if someone signs an obligation which has what they call in their language shufra d'shtara, just like a beautifying of the document, it does not bind one halachically. Sounds a little counterintuitive. He agreed to something which is in the piece of paper, and they didn't really mean it. He followed the intent, didn't mean it. Now, that's a matter of dispute, which, again, if you look in the very last one of the sources, there's a discussion of whether this is really true or not, in a somewhat different context, not the context of the first line of the Ksuba, which we just read, but a different line, which is a very famous line. Whoever was at a Jewish wedding may knows Aramaic, perhaps smile when he hears the expression in the Ksuba, "Tafilu miglimo dal katpoi," which is, you can take the jacket off my shoulders to pay for this obligation. Is that to be taken literally or not? That's the very last of the sources. Some say it's only shufra d'shtara. It's only, it doesn't really mean it. So it's not completely clear whether any of the Torah obligation of support is by Torah law. In my view, based on many sources, at least the minimum is by Torah law. We go beyond that, the higher of the two standards of living, it's a question whether that's Torah law or rabbinic law. And there are differences in details which are found in the last source and others about this question. This is just basics. This is the first prenup, is the Torah itself. We're going to read it again this Shabbos afternoon. That's the very first one. And therefore, there are those who claim no need for any new prenups. We have our Torah. And lest you say that we cannot compel any individual to follow the Torah, which a court certainly cannot do, but they can compel someone to fulfill obligations which are undertaken personally. Since the ksuba is undertaken personally, the halachic mechanism, you pick up an item of value, two witnesses sign it, and I believe that in secular law it's been upheld that the ksuba is enforceable. So that's the end. Just have the ksuba. You want to write it in English to make it more clear. It's enforceable, and therefore we're okay. What it means okay? Okay means only one thing, that therefore there is an obligation of a husband to support his wife. How will that help in alleviating the, what we call today, the Aguna crisis? Well, it's quite simple. If indeed there's an obligation for a husband to support his wife for as long as they are halachically married, this is an incentive. That's all it is. It's an incentive for a man who's no longer experiencing a real marriage, even though technically speaking he's halachically married, the marriage is basically dead, as we call it today. So why should he continue to pay this woman her support, if properly quantified, as we'll get to? Why should he? It doesn't make any sense. It makes more sense for him to give her a get. Now, it makes sense to give her a get even without this, but unfortunately there are those who, for various reasons, for the negotiating posture or some even for spite, don't want to do it. But if there's an incentive to do it, it greatly increases the chances of it being done expeditiously. And therefore, it's wonderful. The Torah itself is wonderful. Torah Hashem Tamima. The rabbis filled in the blanks. We have at least on a rabbinic level a rather high level of support. There's only one problem. The problem is that it's not completely clear what is the proper halacha in the case in which the husband and wife are no longer living together. This is found in the source in the Shulchan Aruch, which is found over here. Again, I can't give you, read all the sources inside. This is found in source number 6. What happens in a situation in which they're no longer living together? So to make a long story short, a little smile, it depends whose fault it is. If it's his fault, he's still obligated to support her, and if it's her fault, then not. I'm sure as attorneys you know that we've tried our very best to go to no fault. There's no fault. Car insurance is no fault. Divorce, everything's no fault. If you're going to worry about fault, till you can resolve it, she may turn white. And therefore that's a gaping hole in the opinion which maintained, well, the ksuba is enough as it stands. And therefore, what our prenup does is it tries to fill that gap. And there are those who feel that we have no right to do so because it's, to use a proper expression today, goes back to Chasam Sofer's time, Chodosh Asim in HaTorah. Whatever is new is no good. We just need the old-time religion. And I'm very sympathetic to that in many areas of halacha. And even here, I'm sympathetic to it. It seems, I don't have the time to go into the history of our prenup, which goes back, it's going back, now it's going back really 30 years. 30 years ago is when I was first involved in 1990 because of a particular case. I will just read you, again, another source inside. Source number 9. Source number 9 comes from Nachlas Shiva. Nachlas Shiva was a student of the Taz. He lived in 17th century Poland. And this is what he has in his Tanoim. Every Tanoim is a prenup. Almost everybody here signs prenups. Aside from the Ksuba, which is mandatory, there's something which is Tanoim, which is voluntary. And almost everyone signs a Tanoim. And in his time, and up to this day in many circles, I would say most circles of observant Torah Jews, this statement still is incorporated by reference. Let me read it to you first in the original. Number 9. Im chas v'shalom sheyasa kemar ploni hanala zugosan mars plonis. Ezu dvorm she'en yichola lisbol l'tzricho lebezdin. Os techef u'miyad yitin la asara zuhuvim l'pizir mezonos. V'chein yitin la kol chodesh v'chodesh v'meshe chimei aktat, etc. V'yered ima b'dine yisrael lebezdin shalahem. Very, very nice. Which means, if they separate, and he's no longer providing for her in the joint marital home, he's required to give her a sum of money, 10 tehuvim, and every month, 10 tehuvim. Hopefully, within 2 weeks, he'll come to the Besdin, and he'll decide what to do. Now, this statement is incorporated in every single classical Tanoim, where it's written, and that's found in source number 10, Umachmas idu uktat yomat kitakonas shum. Shum refers to the three German cities of Speyer, Meiser, and Magenza, where this presumably comes from. There's a discussion in the footnote of Nachlas Shiva, that's the last letter, Yudal in parentheses, which is not here. Where do we find, historically, it was from Shum, but that's what we assume. And it's in every single Tanoim. That's the second line of source number 10. Machmas idu uktat, it should be in Takana Shum, and there you have the footnote, which is we don't know where it comes from. We don't see it in our Takana Shum, but they must have had a tradition that where it comes from. And therefore, we have ample precedent that in a situation where the couple breaks up and no longer living together, that he accepts upon himself to have this obligation to give 10 zuhuvim immediately and 10 zuhuvim every month. This is in my view, quite an impressive precedent for the prenup that we have. The truth is that the prenup had different versions, and when we turned it around way back then, we accepted this version. We weren't fully aware that it was the Takonas Shum and Nachlas Shiva Simetes, but the great rabbis who assisted me were mechaven, as we say. They figured it out properly with this precedent. Full disclosure, the original two rabbis with whom I dealt were Rabbi Zalman Nachum Goldberg and Rabbi Chaim Simbalist from Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv, respectively. Rabbi Simbalist is the one who pushed us into this version. Recently, then we got an askama from Rabbi Vadi Yosef and two other American rabbis. Recently, Rabbi Usher Weiss, a rising star in the rabbinic firmament, has written the beautiful endorsement, except that he doesn't like my precedent. He says the precedent of this Nachlas Shiva was only written in so she shouldn't die of starvation. There was no incentive to write a get. My research into the value of the Ten Zehuvim indicates somewhat otherwise. I don't know if it really matters any, but just want to give it a full disclosure, whether it's a proper precedent for what we have, or perhaps not quite sufficient precedent. It's interesting And this is lead me to my second part of my remarks. I'm looking at the clock. Oh, my password. Clock. Okay. Is that there are, like anything in Jewish life, rabbinic objections to what we are doing. The primary objection, I believe, is what I just said before. Chodesh Asur Min HaTorah. They didn't do it 50 years ago. We shouldn't be doing it now. Of course, the Aguna crisis didn't exist 50 years ago. I'll just give you, just anecdotally. Anecdotally, well, let's go back a little more. Let's go back 60 years ago, a little more, when, I can only speak from personal experience. It's off because anecdotal. I moved in 1958 to Kew Gardens Hills, rather famous community. We davened in the Young Israel, a huge shul of 400 members at the time, and whispered, there was one divorced man in the front row that we spoke about. That was it. One. And that was, today I don't have to tell you how, unfortunately, the exponential increase in divorces, whatever, this, don't have time to go into the reasons right now, but that's a reality which we all are aware of. And therefore, it's become a crisis. You may ask, well, there were divorces all along. What did they do then? There was much more communal pressure, much more communal control when we had a kahila system. You couldn't just disappear. Today, you can go from one shul to another. You can even opt out of orthodoxy completely. These are options which weren't necessarily around in the olden days when there was a unified community system. So the crisis clearly exists. There have been arguments how broad it is, but it doesn't matter. Even if it's one person, we should try to be of help. But unfortunately, it's much more than that, as most of us here are willing to recognize. So, like any good thing, it was an objection. There's no time to go into all the objections, but there are a number of them which I want to mention. The first one is, there's something called asmachta. Asmachta means a contingent obligation. You obligate yourself to something on a contingency. If this, then that. And here we have it. If they're no longer living together, then there's an obligation. Okay? So, how can that be good? Asmachta lo kanya, so says the Gemara. How do you get out of it? So, again, we can't go into all the details right now. Suffice it to say, if you look in some of the sources here that I have, source numbers 14 and 15, quoting from the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, it seems clear to me that we have successfully overcome the problem of Asmachta by the words, and I refer you back now to my main page, which is the first page of our prenup, and the main part of that is what's called the support obligation. Let's talk about it right now. I hereby now, me'achshav, it's a technical term found in the Shulchan Aruch, obligate myself in a manner that I cannot exempt myself with any claim of asmachta, an enforceable conditional obligation. One looks in a sefer called the Divrei Gaonim, not found on my source sheet, the Divrei Gaonim states that if a person states explicitly that I cannot exempt myself with the claim of asmachta, then in fact he cannot. And Rav Tzimbalist wrote us a letter in which he says he hasn't found anybody to disagree with the Divrei Gaonim. I'm sure if you look hard enough you'll find somebody or make up somebody. But that's what he said to us in his letter. That's why we added that language. This is revised November 2018. We can still revise it. If you have suggestions, this is not the Ten Commandments, we're going to read the Shabbos. We can still revise it. We have people here in the room who have been with us from the very beginning. There have been many revisions, and we thank them all. Okay. Or any other claim, to support my wife-to-be from the date of our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reasons, at the rate of $150 per day, and adjusted, etc., etc. In lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, as fine, as here and above cited and circumscribed, that's a legalistic term, we have some good lawyers who helped us, we'll come back to that if we have time later on. So law is the two of us remain married according to Jewish law. Let's stop right over here. So there's an attempt to overcome the problem of asmachta. How so? Number one, me'achshav. Number two, by saying you cannot exempt yourself. And number three, the last sentence here, I acknowledge that I have now me'achshav effected the above obligation by means of a kinyan formal Jewish transaction in an esteemed choshev bezdim as prescribed by Jewish law. If you look in the Hebrew sources, 14 and 15, you'll see these two devices overcome the problem of asmachta. One according to the Shulchan Aruch, one according to the Ramah. It's a dispute between the Rambam and Tosfos. This is common in Jewish law, as we know. So it seems to me that both according to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, two primary halachic decisives for Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews respectively, that we have overcome the problem of Asmachta. Is there anybody who disagrees? You can bet that there is somebody who disagrees, and the someone is a very great someone. His name is Rabbi Yashiv, one of the greatest judges of our time, and he has a opinion that it's true that these overcome Asmachta lo kanya in terms of transference of property, but not in terms of acceptance of an obligation. And with all intellectual honesty, I believe he's 100% right according to the opinion of the Rambam, but not according to the Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, we follow the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, we don't follow the Rambam, so it seems to me that his objection, while being interesting, would not necessarily be a fatal flaw. And one may ask, since Rabbi Yashiv was so outspoken, how come he never came out against our prenup? I spoke to him about it. He had some objections. We'll see soon in another one. I believe the answer to that question is in source number 12. Again, being brief, Rabbi Yashiv writes, he quotes a question, every ksuba on the suffix is an asmachta. Right? Asmachta. So, therefore, if a person signs a ksuba, whatever is mandatory is mandatory, but we have something which is called tosefes ksuba. Every ksuba we have more than this. A ksuba itself is a very little amount of money. It's an amount of silver, which is 10 times the amount of a pinyan aben. If you've been there, it's around $50. The whole ksuba is maybe $500. The real money in a ksuba is in the later, we call it the nedunya, the tosefes, which can run as much as $30,000 or more dollars. I'm not going into the details right now. But that is a contingency obligation. So how does that work? So he writes as follows in source number 12. Rak Mishun Rav Gidol Amarav Mora L'Salek Asmachta. What Rav Gidol Amarav, those are students of the Talmud, know, both in Ksubas and Kiddushin, if the two parents before the wedding say, how much are you giving for your son, how much are you giving for your daughter? No need for a formal transaction. If there's no need for a formal transaction, cannot be undone by Asmachta Lo Kanya. It just undoes formal transactions. Here you don't need a formal transaction. So based upon this response, it seems to me Rabbi Yashiv would not object based on Asmachta for our particular situation. In any event, there are those who don't accept this, as you can well imagine, and they have what we call Asmachta problem, notwithstanding everything that we wrote to overcome it. You lawyers would call it belt and suspenders. But they want something else beyond. I don't know exactly. But we believe, based on the Gedol that we spoke to, that this is completely completely valid. If one wishes to object, they can still rephrase it in the manner which Rav Goldberg originally had, with an unconditional obligation to give X dollars per day, with a corresponding forgiving of the obligation by the wife, except when they get separated. That's very clumsy and wordy, and that's why we didn't want to do it that way. But someone has a guilty conscience for this asmacht issue can still fulfill that obligation just as we have it, just tweaking the language a little bit. Now, $150 a day. Is that too much? Is that too little? So we had spoken a few years ago to a great sage in Jerusalem who had criticized our prenup on the grounds that it's a self-imposed fine. A self-imposed fine, there are Morites and Ebenezer Kuflam and Dalit, would not render a subsequent get invalid, but it should not be done ideally. And this great rabbi thought that in some cases it might even be invalid post facto. We came to visit him, and we told him that it's not a fine at all. It's simply a support obligation. $150 a day? What? What are you kidding? So we were prepared for that question. And one of my congregants, who's an expert in the field, made me a chart of how much it costs per day, approximately, obviously, in various zip codes. Okay? Anybody here come from the following places? Washington Heights, Lower East Side, Upper East Side, or Upper West Side? Raise your hand. Well, guess what? 150 will not crack it. And this is statistics from 2015. So now it's probably even going higher. So, no, yes, it's true. If you come from South Bend, Indiana, it could cost less. Even Lakewood, a little bit less. And anyway, but it's an approximate figure. If it's too much, as we said before, person has a right to reduce it, and therefore we think that it's not a fine at all, and despite our best efforts that the rabbi didn't quite grab it, but okay, that's what we said. One other problem exists. He doesn't have the money. Doesn't have the money. So we said earlier, well, take the shura off his back, right? Well, that might be only a shura for the shtara. So there's a problem. It's called as misadrin lebal chov. He doesn't have enough money to pay so much money per day. To which we responded to this great rabbi, that's only true if he has no other way out. He has no other way out. You're not going to take the shura off his back. It's not fair. If he has an easy way out, well, use your way out. If not, we'll take the shirt off your back. What's the way out? Give a get. The rabbi shook his head. Didn't disagree. So we think that this is a perfectly valid obligation given the parameters that we just said. Now my second objection. The first we get was asmachta with all the stuff. Here's a second objection. The second objection is based on a source we have over here. That is what's called a tiknu mezonos tachas masa yodeha, that she has earnings. And by Jewish law, her earnings belong to the husband. Now, that's a major objection. We tried to address it on page 1 of the prenup by writing as follows. We say the obligation exists even if she has another source of income or earnings. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she's entitled to the above stipulated sum, and I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. What's this all about? The Gemara has in Masechta Ksubos, Daf Pei Gimel, that there's only a short window during which the husband can in fact forgive certain obligations coming to him between what's called erusin and nisuin, between what we call today sometimes betrothal and the marriage. And that's a very small window. Today, he puts the ring on the finger, that's Kiddushin, and in my view, when they finish the Shevet Brachos under the Chuppah, that's the Nisuin. Those who quibble, we're not going to go into that right now.
The reading of the
Ksuvah separates the two. That's exactly what's quoted from Rashi. That's how we have it. So indeed, when forgiveness is recited, that's when it should be recited. I'll give you again a personal example. My father of blessed memory remarried, and they were separate assets, and they wanted it to remain that way, and they wrote a prenup to that effect. And his new wife's daughters lived in the Bnei Brak, and they wanted to make sure their assets were protected. So he went to the late Rav Nissen Karelitz, one of the great judges of our time, and he wrote a cue card for my father to recite exactly at that point in time, after he put the ring on the finger, before the ksuba, before the Sheva Brachos. And it read as follows. Din udvarim eli b'nechasayach v'perasein v'peres perasein ad olam. That's a citation of the Gemara as amplified by the Shulchan Aruch a little bit. And we assume that was a proper time to do it. Now, the late Goyen and Tzaddik Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, my Rebbe, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, did a prenup. I was told he did the prenup right then and there between the Eris and the Nisuin because he's worried about this particular issue. I don't think it's really practical for the masses to do it that way. So we have a formulation that it's true, this is signed before the beginning of the marriage. I recommend that it be signed when the rabbi meets with the prospective husband and wife-to-be. I do this all the time. I just did it on Thursday evening with a student of mine. He's getting married next month. We filled it out. But in order to avoid that problem, we added this idea, I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. Now this works according to many sources. And besides that, there's another consideration. These are all found in the source sheets. The question really is a husband entitled to his wife's earnings nowadays? In the time of the Gemara, the Mishnah, what did she do? She didn't do too much. She was busy in the house knitting a little bit, and that was it. And if she worked herself extra hard, that's called hadafa yedei hadchak, which means she worked harder than she was required to do. According to most sources, he is not entitled to that. That's source 21 and 22. Masi de levala, minig ha-medina, darchon lerag or reges, lukam rokemes. But if she worked harder than she had to do it, then according to the source 22, the psak nowadays, v'mdinas elu lo lahotzi miyara isha shum adofa de'atchak. So he's not entitled to it. Anyway, those that disagree, but you look, there's another source, a remarkable source again from Rav Yashiv, source number 13. He quotes as follows. He says, a woman who made money, nothing to do with avodas temer, etc., minadin and aisha mukhiyevas, a woman is not required to be a lawyer. I see many women lawyers here. A woman is not required to be a lawyer to support the family. And therefore she can say, kimli shalagamri shala. It's all hers. Sorry to disappoint some of the men here in the audience. But if a woman is a lawyer working hard outside the home, the money, according to this Rav Yashiv, I think it's correct by halacha, all belongs to her. So this whole waiver isn't even required. It's hers ab initio for because of what Jewish law has to say. You'll find someone to argue with this too, like anything else. So there are arguments about almost everything, as we've heard. And that's why on page 2, I'd like to turn to page 2, and I'm going to read you just a few lines as follows. The top line, the top paragraph is very, very important on page 2. However, this support obligation shall terminate if, despite husband's to be's compliance with the terms of this agreement and a decision and recommendation of the Beis Din of America, wife to be refuses to appear upon due notice before the Beis Din of America, or in the event that wife to be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the Beis Din of America. This is a critical sentence. If not for this, then a woman can manipulate the system and be supported forever. That's not right. If she comes to Beis Din and she, again, if it will terminate if the wife refuses to appear. Otherwise, she'll just refuse to appear. She won't come, she won't listen, and be supported forever. That would not be right. So therefore, this sentence is critical. Furthermore, wife to be waives her right to collect any portion of the support obligation attributable to the period preceding this date of her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to husband to be that she intends to collect the above sum and has to be notarized, etc., etc., etc. It's independent of chulin. We heard before, I was here at the last part of the previous session, was there ever a 2-1 vote on our Beis Din? There was on such a case. And again, it's a while ago, and this, I think, was found in one of our journals, I think I'm allowed to talk about it, where there was such a disagreement in the following case. Before we put this language in, there was a case that goes back many years when it was only $100 a day. So it goes back, I don't know, probably more than 20 years. A man and a wife were breaking up, and the man said from the first get-go, I'll give you get today. But you know how it is. Until you get everybody together in the Beis Din, you had two parties, and each had attorneys, and the three judges, that's seven people, took 3 months till they found a date which could accommodate everybody. Okay, came to Beis Din, I'll give you get today. She said, no, she wants to go to secular court. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. So she goes to secular court, takes 3 years. Not surprising. People think the Beis Din goes slow. Beis Din is much, you know, everything is relative. Yeah? After 3 years, okay, there's a civil divorce, gives her a get right away. He gets a love note the next week in the mail. $100,000 in back support. It's in the document. There's a difference of opinion in our Beis Din. Two judges said, look, he came to Beis Din. He said, I'm going to give you the money, so from that on, he's not obligated. But for the first 3 months, he's obligated. It's $10,000 he has to give her. Other judge said, come on. He said from the first get-go. She's not denying that. So therefore, she's entitled to zero. Okay. What happened? There's an appeals process. So we've had a majority vote, $10,000. They both appealed. She wants 100 and he wants zero. I was the appellate judge. And I ruled zero. Oh, she went wild. She appealed to the secular court in Maryland, saying that my decision was irrational. You can only, if I understand correctly, you can only either corruption, which there wasn't, or irrationality. Well, the judge said to her, whoa, not only is it not irrational, it's even right. It's correct. So that's that story. So that's what we learned from Aleph to put this in, to avoid this kind of love notes coming after the fact. Okay, that's important. The very last line is also very important. Very last line. As a matter of Jewish law, the parties agree, this is the end of 7, that to effectuate this agreement, they accept now, through the Jewish law mechanism of Kimli, whatever minority view is determined by the residents of America needed to effectuate the obligations, procedures, and jurisdictional mandates contained in this agreement. So all those arguments that we had before, whether Asmacht issue, how much money issue, Mechila issue, all these can be determined by a Kimli, which can make it valid. This is also very, very important. One final objection before I get to some other prenups, which is that Rabbi Yoshe was quoted in an article which goes back to 1988, that perhaps it's a problem the husband will not understand what he is signing. So what? If you have a lease with your landlord, it's an obligation anyway, and the Shulchan Aruch says so explicitly. Never quite understood what he wanted. Maybe he meant that if it becomes commonplace, we'll invoke the Shufa D'Shtar argument. Maybe that's what he meant. But anyway, I can guarantee you today they certainly can know, and they often do know, what's happening. I can give you again from personal experience. We had a wedding in our own community where many of the parents were lawyers, attorneys, and they go back and forth. They knew very well what was happening, and therefore I think this argument is also not going to undo the disagreement. I have to show you on page 1 certain choices which we have. Very, very important. It's called section 2. Section 2, there's the parties will decide all monetary disputes, division of property and maintenance, etc. And they're going to use principles of equitable distribution in accordance with customary practices as the Bezdin deems appropriate according to principles of Jewish law, equity, and local custom. Which means as follows. Sometimes a woman will think, I'll get a better deal in court than I'll get in Bezdin. Of course, she's not permitted to go to a secular court, as we well know. That's in the Pasha. Again, we're going to read it this Shabbos afternoon. Ela mishpata mashatosam lefneihem. Though it has to be in front of a Bezdin. But a Bezdin, as Rabbi Reis referred to a little bit earlier, has the right to take into account Dina de Machusa, at least as a part of what's called a minig, especially if they accept it upon themselves. And we found that equitable distribution, which is not a law of any particular state, the way we phrase it, is something which we feel should be given to the Bezdin as an option that the Bezdin may take into account. Doesn't say we are required to necessarily, is authorized. That's number one. Number two, custody, child support, visitation matters were also authorized. I'm fully aware of the fact that in New York State, no matter what we decide in our Bezdin, the state has the right to review it and to undo it and to change it because they view themselves in charge of young children up to the age of 18. Notwithstanding that fact, I can say that to the best of my knowledge, historically, in over 20 years, it's never happened. It's never happened that we were overturned by a judge in matters of custody and state for a very simple reason. We heard before from that the rules call for an attorney on the Bezdin. That's in the rules. In these kinds of cases, I don't think it's in the rules, but de facto, we have a psychologist on the Bezdin itself. We've often used Dr. Pelkovitz, the greatest of the psychologists in our world, and it's unlikely they're going to overturn him when they look at his credentials that they're better than theirs. So it hasn't happened. I mean, de facto, it hasn't happened. I can't predict the next 20 years, but in 2000, it hasn't happened even once. And therefore, I think it's important that this should be signed for good reasons. If they don't sign it, they don't sign it, and there's nothing we can do about it. Doesn't mean that we allow them to go to secular court. Maybe they can go to another business, or they would resolve it on their own, etc. B2C is also important. The Bezdin of America may consider the respective responsibilities of either or both of the parties for the end of the marriage as an additional but not exclusive factor in determining the distribution of marital property and maintenance should such a determination be altered in paragraphs 2A or 2B. It's also important because although no fault is very popular these days, we have to reserve the right, certainly in egregious cases in either direction, to be able to base ourselves upon the responsibility of the parties. This is my summary, and I only have 10 minutes left, I'm aware of that, of prenups old and new, old going back to the Torah itself, to rabbinic law, and to what's by now pretty old itself. It's 30 years old almost. So, but it's still pretty new, as we said. Now, in the remaining time, I was asked to relate to two very recent prenups, which were written about in a magazine called Mishpacha, a very popular magazine. And I want to address them as well as much time as time allows. Number one, there were those who say we should not have any prenups, because prenups kills the romance. Come on, they're lovey-dovey, and they're going to talk about divorce. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. You may know that's exactly what the Ksuba talks about, except it doesn't mention it explicitly. It's in Aramaic, which most people don't understand. Someone suggests we write our prenup in Aramaic. I'm not ready to do that. This was brought to Rav Moshe Feinstein, this question: can you have any prenup, or is it going to be detrimental in that sense? That's source number 11. Very beautiful tshuva, but has many versions for reasons I'm not going to go into right now. It's Chelek Dalet Simakuv Zayin, written to Rabbi Per Shlit of Far Rockaway. Can you add the following into it tonight? Im Achrein Yisu and Yavol Dei Pirud, they split. Chas V'Sholom, okay. As a baal or ya'akeh militin get pturin ve'ishlo to serve the kablo. Kashekach yitzav ve'bezim ploni. Neither will prevent the get from happening if the other side demands it. And this way, the courts will force them to what Bezin says. How that will happen, that specific performance, I do not understand if Rav Moshe was properly educated from the legal perspective. Rav Moshe writes, it's permissible, the get will be a good get, and it could prevent agunas, but check the chasm kal out if you're afraid that it's going to cause a machlokes between them. Okay. So therefore, we have at least a precedent that some kind of prenup should exist from the pen of the great Rav Moshe Feinstein from 40 years ago, Tavshin Mem. So it's before I was involved, 10 years before, there was already a tumult about this, because Rabbi Per saw too many marriages breaking up with terrible consequences. Okay, so we have that. So that's exactly what a group called Yashar Coalition decided to do, and they got rabbinic approbation, not surprisingly, and come. Will the court force him to appear? I was told that perhaps the court can force him to appear, specific performance, perhaps. They emphasize, as you'll see, and if you have it in front of you, child custody issues and child support issues. They are careful in their language, and they draw a distinction between different states as to, if you look, for example, in paragraph number 3, the Bezin shall arbitrate child custody matters in states that authorize it. Otherwise, they will mediate. I'm told that he refers to New Jersey and New York, respectively. I argued they should write arbitrate in all cases, even in New York, because if you do a good job, they will not overturn you. If they overturn you, so what's lost? But they said, well, maybe the lawyers won't like it, whatever. Unfortunately, there's no explicit reference here to support. In paragraph 15, Bezin shall hear any and all issues raised by the parties. I'm not an expert in arbitration law, documents of arbitration. If you spell it explicitly, child custody, and leave out support, it could cause an attorney to try to question whether, in fact, support is under the aegis of this particular Bezdim. But more than that, since there's no explicit undertaking by the husband himself, we're hard-pressed to understand what they're going to do if they're split up, and the husband knows what it says in Shulchan Aruch, because they allow Tohanim, okay, but we don't, for reasons we discussed in the previous session. And he'll say, it's her fault. And until they prove conclusively that it's in fact his fault, then, technically speaking, she's not entitled to the money. And if you give the money despite that fact, it can run to a problem of an illicit decision, which can, in theory, cause an illicit get. So the fact that there's no additional obligation, it causes a bit of a problem. The response was as follows, and I hope he's right. The response was, once you get him into Bezdin, 90% of the problems will be solved. I hope to be proven wrong. I told him I don't believe it for a minute, but I hope to be proven wrong. Let's hope this catches on. If they don't want to use ours for whatever reason, let them use theirs. It's certainly, I would say, they say, better than nothing. Okay, how much better than nothing? We're not going to argue right now. But better than nothing, so I'm not going to discourage people who want to do it that way. Fine. It's interesting, at the very same time, another bezin called Varadin Vaharah, that's based in Muncie, they're based in Brooklyn, both came to see me. The Brooklynites saw me across the street, and the Muncie came to my house in Riverdale and had long discussions about these things. And once again, there's no acceptance of an additional obligation, but it's a reference to rules and procedures. In rules and procedures, it says if you don't listen to what Bezin says, it could cost you up to $500 a day. That's pretty impressive. However, it's properly circumscribed. If you look here, just carefully, that one line, if you have it in front of you, it's page 17 of the rules and procedures. They say in the paragraph 3, it's B3, right? It could be $500, but it says in B3, contingent upon said charge being halakhically viable. Haha, that's quite a contingency. I don't know if it's proper in the case where it's going to force someone to give a get. So it is a problem comparable to the Ashar, but once again, if it's going to work, it'll work. We hope it'll work in their circles. I have to say that our prenup, although it's very, very effective, is not completely effective. It's not a panacea. I would not be honest if I told you that. There are going to be at least two cases when it doesn't work. If the husband is very, very rich or very, very poor. If he's very, very rich, he may love to keep his wife in Aguna ad infinitum by giving $150 a day. It's meaningless to him. If he's very, very poor, he'll say, and I'm judgment proof. In those two extremes, it won't work. But you know what the bell curve looks like? These extremes are tiny slivers of the population. Most of us fall in between. If you fall in between, it's proven to be very, very effective. I want to end, because I only have 2 minutes on the clock, I want to end by encouraging all couples getting married to sign the prenup and to include section 2, which is optional, both parts. They may think that they're better off in court, but I believe that the reality dictates otherwise. A judge may here and there give them a few more dollars, but life is more than dollars. Life is not being an aguna. And if the woman, in fact, goes to secular court, in many of these cases, the prenup won't help her because she's not following the recommendation decision of Bezin. Unless Bezin told her to go to court, which happens in some situations. Number two, as attorneys, I encourage you, when you meet with clients or in general have conversations at Shalashuddis or wherever you at the Kiddush, to talk about the prenup. We got a boost by the cover story on Mishpacha magazine. It helped us out in circles we didn't have so much access before. We need more. We need more help, both in our own circles and in other circles. I end with a tefillah that our joint efforts together with all of those who are trying to help will eliminate as much as possible this scourge of the aguna. How widespread, I said before, we don't know how it is, but if there's even one case, it's a stain, it's a blot on our community. We hope and pray that they'll all be solved. My guess is that will happen until the Mashiach comes. But at least for the present moment, let us solve as much as we can. Thank you very much. Okay.